Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio, my friends. This is Henrik Palmgren. I'm glad you're here today. We have an interesting program ahead of us. Wayne Herschel from thehiddenrecords.com is with us. And if you've been with us for a while, you know that Wayne was on this program back in November, I think, of last year, if I remember correctly. And we talked about his fascinating book called The Hidden Records, about human origins and the connection to the stars and where we might be from. And today we're going to kind of follow up on that program and go off on a very interesting tangent and talk about the Forbidden Star Map, or the Hiram Abiff Star Map. And this is brand new stuff. Wayne published an article back in July, I think, this year. And this is, you know, fascinating stuff that dives into everything from the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, to the blazing star of Ra, and the absolutely fascinating connection to the Freemasonic Tracing Board. There's a lot of pictures to look at today, and I'm certainly going to have these linked up from the info page so people can follow along on the article that Wayne has published or put up on his website, thehiddenrecords.com. Also, another site you need to take a look at is keyofsolomon.net, and if there's time, we're going to probably dive into that also and talk about that. So again, there's much to talk about today, and so let's bring on our guest and get things going here. Hi, Wayne. Welcome back to Red Ice Creations Radio.
Great to be back. Thanks, Fredrik.
Excellent. It's great to have you here. Thank you again for coming on. And wow, you know, I've been going through the material here, and there's much fascinating to talk about. And just let me read a few lines here from your article here about the Forbidden Star Map. Over the past few years, Freemasons have come from all over the world, quite conspicuously, one might add, to attend Wayne's Pyramid Star Map talks. Some very interesting comments were made in a private conversation that transpired after the talks. A number of people told Wayne that they had always known that the stars his research focused on are extremely important. They also admitted that they had never realized exactly why they were so important until now, especially since it would seem that virtually all of the ancient civilizations venerated these particular stars in some sort of Genesis theme. They commented that their once secret star depiction, which they refer to as theirs, the first degree tracing board of the Key of Hiram, had recently become a public available historical document. And we're going to talk about that here today, and that's an interesting point there, Wayne. And the idea, of course, is that we're going to talk about this tracing board from the Hiram Key. But tell us, how did you stumble upon this document, or this image, I should say?
I have to credit Dan Brown for that. During my research, just before publishing my book a couple of years ago, it was at a time the Da Vinci Code was hardly known, but my brother had the book and said to me, you know, you should have a look at some of this material. Mm-hmm. It speaks of human encoding into ancient places. The mention at the time wasn't really including the Solomon Key or anything like that, but it was basically that there was some kind of Freemason secret tying in with these Da Vinci, Vitruvian Man pictures, etc., etc. And I'd already had worked on some sort of part of the interpretation of the Vitruvian Man, and started looking into some of the Freemason materials a couple of years ago, but there wasn't that much available. But I was very fortunate to have an old book by a Freemason called The Arcana of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. And on the cover, he has this picture of what to me instantly looked like a star map. It had a star with a beam of light coming down from it, like you see in a lot of the Bethlehem star kind of depictions. And of course, a grouping of a cluster of seven stars up to, you know, to the top right-hand part of it. And realizing that this is kind of very sensitive material, you know, you don't just go writing about Freemasonry 3 or 4 years ago. You know, you put it aside and take it with a pinch of salt and just wait for somebody else to write about it. nobody did. So here I am quite a few years later now. Things have changed really dramatically, probably because of Dan Brown predominantly. There's hundreds of books now of authors researching Freemasonry and writing about it, some respectfully and some not. I'm quite sort of grateful that I've been treated well by fellow Freemasons that have come to my talks and said that, you know, you show respect and we'll treat you accordingly. And if I speak poorly of them, then don't expect to, you know, to be aided in my project research or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them told me that the Bradford University in the United Kingdom has exposed their original most valuable tracing board, the first degree tracing board. And it's open topic, you know, go ahead, research it. It looks like your material. And I already told him, I realized it was similar, but it's time now to let people know what it might mean, which is a great thing. I mean, it's got a positive meaning. It's nothing to be afraid of or something we shouldn't really touch. It's got a really positive outcome, something to do with human origins.
Sounds wonderful. You know, let's talk about the tracing board. I hope that people are, you know, have clicked on the links and are in on the website right now so they can see the images, you know, in front of them. But let's go through the Masonic tracing board first and you know, talk a little bit about what we see there.
The amazing thing about it is you've got these, it's like a triangulation effect in the sky. I'm just going to just quickly open the image so I don't mislead anybody. The top left-hand side, it looks like a normal sun. The top right-hand side almost looks like a moon depiction with stars around it, because there are stars, so you expect, well, it can't be the sun and stars, it must be the moon. And, of course, in ancient civilizations, the sun and the moon seem to play an important part. And that is a general sort of interpretation by many Freemasons, that it is this sort of recognition of the importance of the sun and the moon and seven stars.
Mm.
But the one at the bottom part that has seven points of light on it in a circle and a ladder coming down from it, that is referred to as the blazing star.
Mm.
And it's quite amazing that you see a hand coming out of it holding what represents, I think, the Holy Grail. So this is a Christ-related star story.
Mm.
So that's where it begins. Now, you have the star pattern, and people that have seen my research will go straight to the Mars star map and compare it, and that's probably the most detailed star map that I've come across, which shows two important stars near the Pleiades, if these are the Pleiades, for example, and just sort of do an overlay, and you'll see they're in the general sort of positions. But the third one, the one that's sitting with the Pleiades, I realized it wasn't the moon. It's a third sun-like star. So my book has an extra, there's three sun-like stars in contention here. All three of them are measurable astronomically. They've got star codings, they're HD references, Hubble telescope references.
Mm-hmm.
They are nearby sun-like stars, all three of them, which I think is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, definitely.
And, so we have this pattern in the sky, and there's three pillars on the ground. And the three pillars on the ground, I was completely baffled at first. Why? They're showing them, some have got more carving. If you look at the tops of the pillars, one in the front has got almost no carving on the top.
Mm-hmm.
Then the middle one has a little bit more, and then the one nearest the ladder has a lot of carving on it. And then, of course, the famous checkered pattern floor.
Yeah.
I basically tinkered with it for quite a while, the university site has a lot of text on the ritual. And I get very put off when I read in the actual ritual, because it's very... I wouldn't say off-putting from the sense of destructive. It's more, it's just, to me, it doesn't seem to be valid research. But then I did go through it, and it speaks of the pillars as from the Genesis text of Jacob, where Jacob put a pillar on the ground to mark the place where this ladder came down from the heavens. So this pillar interpretation is Jacob's ladder. Is there anything you want to mention at this point?
You know, tons of stuff, too much almost. You know, there's of course the timeline, and we'll get into that. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Let's see here. But how did you kind of so you took the tracing board and compared it with the star map that you have in your book, The Hidden Records? Is that right?
That's right. It actually showed that extra third sun-like star. And I went back to the Mars star map, and there is actually an anomaly that correlates with this extra sun. It looks almost like the Mars face. It's an oval anomaly.
Mm.
I went back to the Stonehenge interpretation, and there's a huge long barrow that's next to the area that represents the Pleiades, the same as there.
Mm.
And then, of course, a whole new story comes into contention now, the cradle of civilization, the ruins of Babylon. Have three large ziggurats that Saddam Hussein rebuilt in the area around the original lost ruins of Babylon. And mm-hmm. it's quite amazing now that even that has a pattern match.
That's amazing. And that's not the only one. There is one in Tikal, I think, and one in England, I guess, and even at Sidonia, of course.
Yeah, the most amazing one is, of course, Sidonia, because that was a large anomaly that I've actually clipped off the picture. You'll see in my pictures of Sidonia, I actually cut the picture on that edge there, because at the time, I didn't want to add in that third star, and I didn't want to write about Freemason secrets. I just thought that would be guaranteeing myself problems. Why involve it when I don't really need to?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the time has come. People want to see the full meaning of a better part of the story, and that's how this links with the Solomon key. That's the exciting part.
Yeah, you know, we talked a little bit before we, you know, before we began here the recording, and just, you know, the interesting idea that you've been approached by Freemasons who doesn't seem to, they themselves have the, you know, full meaning of you know, of the symbols or the images that they have access to.
It seems like, you know, I really thought that they would, but when you go back and see what is now their records that they've made open to the public, it's very symbolic of important heavenly meaning, important as far as the biblical reference to the Jacob story, as far as angelic references, the Egyptian great secrets are brought in as well. It's quite a big subject that I couldn't really comment officially on, but what I did see is the star pattern, which it seems nobody has recognized, and that I'm sure if anybody knew about it, they would probably have printed it or written something on it or be very quick to tell me there's a copyright on it or anything. But you know, I've been very fortunate to write the story and copyright the book with a star pattern and didn't know anything originally about how big the story would be, but it's just growing bigger and bigger. And I've been treated well by Freemasons that have come ahead and said, you know, this is important to get out there and speak well of it and just show a bit of respect.
Yeah, let's see here. So, I mean, let's begin to talk a little bit about the, I guess, the star to the left, and also the pillar that is in the foreground of the image. And I guess that if we are to put a timeline on here, we end up at 200,000 years ago as the kind of the human origins, I guess.
Yeah, it took me a while to work out the timeline. If you look at the floor, all those little checkered patterns seem to be measuring very neat, because remember, geometry is very important to the Masonic people, that it has importance in all angles and sizes and distances. Everything has meaning mathematically. Mm. So notice the pillars were carefully placed along this sort of perspective going to the horizon. And there's three pillars, and if you look, obviously, there's three round orbs, which I started calling orbs in the beginning, but they're three sun-like stars, three pillars. So each pillar represents the star that's in line with it. For example, the pillar on the left is in line with the one on the full left above it. The pillar on the right is obviously the one on the right. And the one that's kind of at the horizon is the closest to the middle one. Hmm. That's the most ornate one. And I was measuring the horizon distance to that pillar is pretty much two blocks. And I was guessing if my theory is, you know, 17,000 years, according to the movement of the stars fitting perfectly in all the star maps, if my 17,000-year period is right for this blazing star, the middle one, then let's use one square equals 20,000 years. 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. 20,000 years, and keep adding it on, and just see how far we go back. And to the middle pillar, it's about 100,000, and to the one in the foreground, it's 200,000, and that fits pretty neatly with fossil records of modern Homo sapiens fossil records.
So what we're talking about here is that in the tracing board there is a decoded message of not only of the origins of the human race, but also actually aligning itself with your theory about the fact that humanity came to this planet, right?
It seems like three different arrivals. The one, obviously, 200,000 years ago would have been, according to the pillar, being hardly carved. It's a very simple beginnings, and perhaps ancient astronauts finding our solar system and perhaps using it as a penal colony. Testing it out with, you know, jumping penal colony instigators into this planet, seeing how they cope. And over time, it looks like there was a second one that came, you know, a whole 100,000 years after it. And that's the pillar to the right. And again, perhaps very simple sort of beginnings, maybe starting some of the foundations of Atlantis.
We
can only guess on that sort of basis.
Sure.
But the one on the middle is associated with all the other star maps. That's this one that happens about 17,000 years ago, where there seems to be a mass visitation. Let's call it the real colonization of this world by perhaps all different people from all over the cosmos.
And almost, I think you refer to it in your article as to almost the invasion of this planet, and hence the consequence of that was the annihilation of the Neanderthals?
Neanderthal. It's quite an amazing thought. You know, how many times have they written science fiction stories and one day this world will be invaded by aliens? And imagine these big UFOs coming in and wiping us out.
Yeah.
It's happened. I think it's something of the past. You know, we're kind of arrogant, thinking we still knew and have all this greatness and, you know, nothing's really happened before us. But it's quite likely that this is what happened 17,000 years ago. This world at that time had Neanderthal as the hominid, the Earth-evolved hominid ready to inherit the Earth.
Mm.
And our ancestors came along and said, you know, this place is great. Don't worry about the Neanderthal. They might not have just wiped him out. I think that's unethical and probably unnatural. I would say that more than likely the poor Neanderthal was moved out of his territories and, if anything, caught disease from us and maybe died out without us realizing that we destroyed them.
Fascinating. And I guess also that this, looking at the star map, the image you have on your website, that this is something even to do with the fact that this is something you can see if you're standing looking towards the east, where you could find the Pleiades on the right-hand side, and the blazing star towards the middle. Do we have to back up in time here, or how does that work?
Yeah, we should mention that the window you're looking at, the tracing board, has the coordinates on it. Now, in any star map, you need to know, you know, which is the northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, west, east. So you need those four cardinal points. You also need to see where you're viewing from. Your point of view is, in this case, standing where the W is in front of the block. So you're standing in a westerly direction, looking at the horizon in the east.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is very important in Egyptology. The ancient Egyptians revered the rising of stars on the horizon for some unknown reason. I think it's because they're basically coming into view and they've arrived, kind of thing. I think this is the whole meaning behind the Sphinx, watching not the sun, but watching the stars coming up, and of course, important stars.
Mm. And so one interpretation here is that all of these stars that are depicted here in the star map are potentially then could have planets around them that are inhabited even to this day, I guess.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, you can't think of people coming from stars. They're coming from solar systems. It's quite likely. I mean, you ask any astronomer now, they're quite open about it, because if you asked 5 years ago, even 10 years ago, if they thought there was other planets and life out there, they'd probably say very unlikely. But you'll see the change in tone now. They're finding planets common with nearby stars, and the size of them, you know, basically suggests that there's a lot of material to make planets, and there's probably going to be a lot more solar systems out there like ours.
And we could tie in here the fact that potentially Mars was the planet that from the start was inhabited. And I think you mentioned in your article also that the advantages was better on Mars, because here on Earth things doesn't seem to be quite right for humans.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, it's quite strange that we can look at it from that angle, because we consider, well, this is perfect. We only know the Earth, but if you look at the human makeup and the skeletal structure and muscle connection, we're 1/3 retarded in both bone density and muscle connection. And that's really odd. Why would we be mutated? Why would we be a reject, so to speak, in this Eden? And every other animal in the animal kingdom is equipped for it. You know, if you look at the bone density of Neanderthal and compare it to us, it's quite a joke. I mean, they're more like a gorilla, whereas we are very frail creatures in respect. And it seems quite likely, if you take Mars, and NASA has announced that it's 100% fact, it was once like the Earth with oceans. I've got the article on my Mars page on the website that they say even Pacific Ocean-sized water masses on Mars. That's quite amazing. So
yeah,
if it had that, it would have had pretty much a natural ingredient for life as well. It would have been cows, it would have been lightning, it would have been amino acids forming. Very, very similar to ours. I'm pretty sure you'll see that that sort of key code is common in the universe, you know, where there's the effect of lightning fixing amino acids and the slow process of life building. I think if you look at the Mars gravity as well, it would have been a bit bigger than the planet appears now because it has a huge impact crater. I think it's 2,000 kilometers wide. Imagine what kind of meteor impact would make a hole that big in the planet and how much material was blown out into space.
Yeah.
It was a lot bigger before, better gravity, probably about half our gravity. Imagine the planet being at that distance from the sun. On the equator, estimates are that it would be around perfect optimal temperature for human beings, around about 25 degrees Celsius. And very gentle weather, because of the size of the planet, it won't be as vigorous as our weather. Very gentle, very nice golden sunlight, not damaging people's eyes, no need for glasses. And of course, half a gravity means you're kind of like a Superman. Imagine doing a triple somersault out of your bed in the morning. Like you see monkeys jumping from trees and that. We would be able to do the same as the apes, which is fair, isn't it? I mean, that seems to be the right place for us. And I would say that was the jewel of the solar system, and Earth would be a second plan, something that you know, researchers can go to, or a place for convicts, maybe a penal colony civilization, until Mars was overpopulated, and anybody can guess from there onwards.
That's so amazing. I mean, okay, so let's bounce around an idea here that Mars, what was inhabited at first, and the Earth was, as you say, used as a penal colony. Then something happened on Mars, meaning that there might potentially only be the, you know, the bad guys left here on Earth.
Yeah, I think it's quite likely that because Mars was closer to the asteroid belt, whatever caused the asteroid belt, Mars was closest to it and took a large impact that destroyed it and murdered the planet. I would say in high probability that because they were advanced people with technology to space travel, most of them would have evacuated, probably a lot perished in the process because it couldn't have taken everybody. But at the same time, they probably came back many hundreds of years later, because you can imagine they would have gone deep space looking for another solar system, and in time, you know, want to come back and do research back in this solar system, perhaps hundreds and hundreds, maybe even thousands of years later. And the Earth survivors, penal colony, descendants of descendants of descendants, lost the ability to read and write, and they draw pictures in caves like we see in the Lascaux caves. I mean, there's a star map that's 17,000 years old, written, drawn by cavemen, that show the great detail of Taurus, the Pleiades, and the little X star that marks the spot. So, and I think when they came back again, what did we do? We revered them as gods.
That's amazing, and that's also, I guess, where the tie-in with the, even with the angels themselves, potentially, that you know, what when we think back of our, you know, religions or mythology or whatever you want to call it, that the so-called angels actually potentially then might be highly advanced, technologically speaking at least, highly advanced beings, or humans, I should say, but coming from, from another planet, right?
I 100% agree. In fact, a theologian that was a Jehovah's Witness, very open-minded Jehovah's Witness, chap I met in Durban quite a few years back, even said to me, you know, if you think of the simplicity of teachings in the ancient times, they would want people to listen and hear these great testimonies. If a testimony had too much complication and technicality in it, it actually makes people start doubting how, for example, a disc, a flying disc could fly, but it doesn't have bird's wings. So it's quite likely, theologians agree, quite generally now you'll see it in open research, angels having bird's wings, and these discs that you see in Egypt and in Sumeria having bird's wings, which is not the sun flying with bird's wings, of course, it's probably a disc because it was a flying disc that these angels arrived in, had to be taught as able to fly, and that's the only way to write it down and depict it. And I think it's carried through with traditions, very romanticized, and I think very effective in the old days. I'll tell you what, it's not working today.
That's a good point. And you know, let's talk a little bit about the about Hiram Abiff, because there's, you know, a lot of questions arise here when we think of where Masons first got this tracing board from. You know, do we have an idea about that?
it's a very rough idea, and I've took a great deal of care in researching it with the university people as well, and with a couple of Freemasons that even they said to me, you know, they're embarrassed to talk about it because they don't even have these texts that they can just go in and get all the detail. It's basically spoken about in their meetings, and you know, you're just not supposed to speak to the public about it, so go out there and go to the university and find out for yourself. Basically, what I found is it is, according to the University of Bradford, that this whole, in fact, they name the whole first degree tracing board, second degree, third degree, under the, I think it's the web of Hiram. Actually, you name it after Hiram. So that, to me, suggests that it's based around the legend of Hiram Abiff. And he had the secret that he was murdered for. He wouldn't tell his fellow stonemasons his grand secret that he thought was absolutely important, and he died for it. It's quite likely that his other fellow workers, other masons, found this first-degree tracing board, or first-degree, well, what we call the first-degree tracing board now, was something that we see in this image that we've been talking about. And it was a very mysterious way of recording, marking timelines with pillars, with stars above in the sky, and telling a story without words. And I think it's been drawn and redrawn, and a lot of detail might have even been adjusted on this, but I tell you what, it's pretty accurate as it stands today, comparing it to my star map theory.
Fascinating. And
I think that was, that's probably the source of it, Hiram Abiff. Nobody will really know, but it seems the university feels strongly about it as well, that it is that source.
So the question is, if Hiram actually was, you know, was he murdered because he didn't want to share his you know, his secrets,
didn't want to share his secret.
Or was it that he actually you know, had a secret that you know, people around him didn't want to be you know, exposed, or you know, carried on in tradition?
I think they threatened him with his life, and he took a blow to the head. He didn't reveal the secret, and it's quite likely that they went and looked in his dwellings, and lo and behold, there's this manuscript. I would imagine very Egyptian-looking manuscript, perhaps. I think it could even be even slightly Hebrew. I mean, I never thought the Hebrew aspect out of it might even be important, but it's quite likely there's a link with the Hebrew historical Genesis as well, with the Solomon key showing almost a mirror story based on another whole depiction. Now we have pillars and stars. Now on the Solomon key, they're showed in a different way. Similar puzzle, but same meaning.
So, okay, and, you know, just going back a little bit again to the star map here, is there anything suggesting in the star map now that that a third visitation is possible, that the gods is coming back? Is there anything like that in there?
I don't think so. I think we can look at our human ethics and look at our history and see what's happened to all our religions, and we were visited by these grand teachers, these heavenly visitors, initially treated them well, but it's quite likely that our emotion, there's something about human emotion seeing a UFO, and I can speak from my own experience, having seen something as a teenager. I tell you what, you become emotionally attached to this subject of UFOs. It's weird. There's something in us that wants to attach to this visitation of something extraterrestrial. And it's quite likely that the whole historical records show that we get so emotionally involved with these visitors, they might have taken some of our own offspring. They might have had hybrid, half human, half themselves, replenishing the gene pool in the cosmos and taking children away, their children, half their children, probably under great acceptance by great civilizations all across the globe. But when they didn't come back, it's quite likely that they started sacrificing their own children initially to the gods to come back, you know, an emotional belief that they will see what's going on from the sky. And this is what we do. I mean, if you look at the Christ story, I'm pretty sure that his origins, his lineage is part, not just Mary lineage, part those that come from the heavens. And I think it's quite sad that what did we do? We killed him. We can blame ourselves for that and try and excuse ourselves for doing what we did, but we murdered him. And it's quite likely since then, any kind of visitation in remote cases that we've never heard about, let's say the Mayans were visited thereafter and whatever, I think it's quite likely they were kidnapped and killed and who knows what, things that we've never, you know, heard about. Just so violent and so untrustworthy, over-emotional, warlike, and I don't think anything's going to change until, for example, the the air forces around the world, all the United States Air Force, Russian Air Force, British Air Force, Chinese Air Force, they all have this protocol to shoot unidentified flying objects out of the sky and then ask questions later.
Really,
that's
do they?
Our protocol. That's an international protocol.
Really?
Search for technology, yep, and it's quite likely the fear of somebody threatening a country.
Yeah.
Shoot them down, then ask questions later. And when that changes one day, I think they'll know, and then they'll come.
I guess we could tie this back to, I think it was called the Brookings Report, and also the and as an extension, I think, of the McDaniel Report that talked about, you know, the official line of any kind of visitation is that a visitation from somewhere out there on this planet would basically mean the total, you know, reformation of our society, our way of life, and our world. So, and with that in mind, the official governments, I think, through the Brookings Report, came to the conclusion that that is not a good way to do it, because our world would basically be reformed, meaning that we don't take any chances like this. So that what I'm getting at here is that potentially there might be a connection between these two, then, that they're so afraid of any kind of change to our world and our way of life, so that they actually go to the length of shooting at something that is, you know, from out there.
You can imagine the human ethics involved and the arrogance that we have, that, you know, that we should tell them what to do, and we should demand technology from them. I believe this whole Roswell thing really happened, and I believe Eisenhower tried to negotiate with advanced beings for technology, and kind of embarrassed ourselves a bit from those earlier days. And you know, they're not going to come and visit us openly and effectively. If they landed in Washington D.C., came down wanting to shake hands and walk with us and speak with us, I guarantee you now they'll be arrested and not allowed to leave until we decide that they can leave.
Yeah, sheesh, my God, yeah, talk about embarrassing, you know. And you know, I want to get back, I guess, a little bit to talking about Jacob's Ladder. That's a story or a myth that is very interesting, to say the least. And you know, Jacob, while witnessing the detailed vision that he had, what I think was told that humanity was literally given this world. Isn't that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's spelled it out very beautifully in Genesis. And you know, after reading that and seeing this picture, and in fact, I would challenge anybody who's looking at this picture right now just to get hold of their Bible, dig up the Genesis text, and have a look at where it mentions the ladder, where he marks the pillar on the ground. And there's hidden meanings in various Bibles. I've got a 100-year-old Bible, and I've got one that's a modern Bible, and you'd be amazed the detailed difference in between the two. It's like the Ezekiel story as well. If people have got an old Bible, get hold of a new one. In the old Bible, it's a wheel within a wheel on its side. Whereas a new one will say, "Oh no, it's a wheel intersecting a wheel, and it's a hallucination. You know, it was a vision." But it just shows you how it's evolving, how things are changing over time. So it's worth getting out the old Bibles and having a comparison to, especially the Solomon Key as well.
Speaking of the ladder itself, there's a lot of speculation on what that might be. If we tie this back, we look at the tracing board. Towards the middle pillar that is, of course, a ladder, and as you say, a hand reaching down with a potentially a grail at the end of the ladder. But when Jacob had his vision of this, what do you have an idea or a theory about what the ladder actually was or means?
Yeah, I have a very sort of, because we don't have enough information, I can only guess. Trying to imagine what he saw, he was probably shown this kind of image as a teaching mechanism to show which star we came from. We've also got to look at what other references we have to compare with a star and a beam of light down from it. We've got it obviously in the Solomon Key, but let's not go there yet. Let's look back and look at some of the stuff we looked at previously in our last radio show. The Egyptian Senmut tomb has exactly that star with a beam of light coming down from it, and Pleiades interpretation and an Orion interpretation, all in the right place. I'm pretty sure this kind of teaching mechanism has been shown to us by visitors to, I think in the case of Jacob, I'm not convinced it was God speaking to him. I'm more convinced it were these advanced heavenly beings, call them angels. I don't think it was the creation itself of the universe coming all the way down to our little earth and saying, "Hey, you know, this is who you are and where you come from." I think it's quite likely a simple teaching mechanism. Maybe he had something carved on a tablet that he could take, you know, and show his people, or maybe he just was showing it and tried to celebrate it by building this pillar on the ground in a pattern. To me, it sounds almost like a pyramid building pattern where you make the pyramids match the stars to tell the story.
Mm.
And in the case of putting down a few pillars, it makes me think of another great story, which I think it is, where is it now? Somebody told me they've got a place in Greece where there's seven great obelisks that have been built in an old temple.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And, it sounds to me like obelisks more than pillars might have been the case as well, to mark the positions of stars and then later bigger pyramids, perhaps.
Hmm, really? Wow, that's fascinating. So again, we're back at the seven stars of Pleiades, or the seven sisters. I mean, a lot of people are, when we speak about the seven, I've heard reference to that this is, in accordance with what is known as the ancient lights of the world, the seven known planets at the time. And even, because I know in your article that you go into the connection with the menorah, the Hebrew light candle with the seven lights on it, but you have a different than interpretation here of that, right?
I don't think it's that different, because I've met a few Hebrew people since I've done that article, and they kind of said they knew that anyway.
Really?
The seven candlesticks of the menorah celebrate seven celestial lights. Some Hebrew people seem to have tradition passed down that they've always known about this, whereas it's not published. I haven't found it anywhere written, but maybe it's just a coincidence that they've interpreted it like that. But go back to earlier times. We have electricity now, but the light, the burning flame, was artificial light. You wanted to celebrate seven stars that are important in heaven. Seven candlesticks are a very neat way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the actual symbol of the Hebrew Star of David ties in with seven celestial lights as well. And the most important extra part of it is in the middle of it to make an eight. This is quite amazing. It's seven. It's got 6 points when you put the Star of David together, the two triangles.
Mm.
And it also symbolizes the number seven. So I think it's really like that. If you look back at the tracing board again, we have seven, you know, points of light on that star. And to me, a simple thing about seven being sacred there is just to tell the viewer that it's near the Pleiades, seven, near the seven stars. It's kind of a remembering pattern, if you can call it that. That's the most logical thing to me.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Let's see here. And then we, of course, have the secret symbols on the $1 bill, and this is a fascinating story, and the $1 bill is you know, obviously something that keeps coming up again and again, and there's so many different interpretations of what the seals mean and all of this, and
that's good.
Yeah,
the Freemasons say in this university text that there are multiple meanings, and they even said there's seven meanings for everything you see in every Freemason depiction.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the sacred number seven comes up. They want it to be so intellectually put together that one thing can mean a bigger story. And it's quite amazing, because this tracing board is starting to tell a whole lot more.
Yeah, definitely. And, I've seen the, if we talk about the anagram, of course, in the seal itself, it scrambles up to Mason if you twist and turn the letters, and some I've seen people that actually just place basically Star of David above the right on top to get this
easier way.
Exactly, but yours is a little bit different. You use a pentagonal shape and then with a beam. Well, tell us about it. How did you came up?
Basically, I've taken the two seals, the left and the right, because remember, there's one seal. It starts off with the writing, the Great Seal of the United States is actually written on the other seal. So the two are actually a duo. They have a dual connection.
Mm-hmm.
Doing an overlay with one over the other on a computer, it works very easily than actually trying to do it on the dollar bill by folding it and trying to look with the sun shining through it. You'll see that the triangle part of the capstone blocks out of the bulk of the stars on the above the eagle on the other seal.
Mm-hmm.
You're left with that exact star formation of three stars, the point facing downwards of the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
The which I think is pretty amazing. And of course, you've got the pyramid beneath it. So you have,
yeah,
as above in the heavens, the three forming an upside down equilateral triangle, if you can imagine.
Mm.
And of course, you have the pyramid on the ground. It's making a pyramid in the sky, a pyramid on the ground. Think of the Da Vinci Code of the Louvre in Paris. It has the pyramid pointing up on the top and a pyramid pointing down underneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure this is an age old symbol for as above, so below.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. Let's see, and there's so many other, you know, avenues to take from here. One thing here, of course, that has been coming up, and I think that this was linked from your article, was about the secret layout or design of Vatican City and the key of Saint Peter. And I, and the first time I saw this, I was absolutely blown away. I linked that article up on my website. How the heck did you discover this one? Because I've heard about this, the key, of course, but what, yeah, I've seen before previously was a smaller key in just the region that didn't include the castle at Sant'Angelo, I guess. But
yeah,
how did you discover this?
Well, it's actually a follow-on from the Solomon key, because we have the key of Hiram, we have the Solomon key. They're all the key to unlocking some grand cosmic secret. And, of course, the key of St. Peter is another one, not really well known, of course. And the statue you see at the Vatican, it's him standing. I like the statue. In fact, that is a real Dan Brown story. And it was in Angels and Demons, I think, yeah, Angels and Demons.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look carefully at the statue of St. Peter in the Vatican, he's holding the key in the same hand and he's pointing down the causeway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one merely follows past the obelisk. I thought the obelisk was initially the most important representation of what I was hoping for is the star interpretation. But that was before I understood the whole piazza. And if you look at the piazza from above on Google Earth, it's the sacred chi rho, which is the symbol given to Christ, which is an X and a P.
Mm-hmm.
And the X formation and the P. Now, this is Constantine's testimony. And I tell you what, there are so many variations of it. Again, we have to use a lot of speculation because some say one thing, some make it more miraculous what he saw in the sky, like a burning cross. Some say it was something very natural in the sky,
mm-hmm,
to me, stars. Mm-hmm. Take the constellation of Orion, it makes an X formation with the four outer stars. And we have, of course, the three in the middle, the belt stars.
Mm-hmm.
And from more my research, those are the pointers. Those are the three that point that you follow in a line to find this very important sun-like star.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very neat way of showing it, an X and a P. So taking that a little bit further, looking at the piazza in the Vatican, looking at it from above, it is that big X formation with a line through it.
Mm-hmm.
If that is Orion, and it's mimicked on the ground, in large size that can be seen from high altitude, followed down the causeway, which is now in line with the three belt stars, so to speak, out of that cross formation of Orion, go down the causeway, go right down, and looking from above, what's at the bottom, the Castello d'Angelo, Sant'Angelo, I should say,
mm-hmm,
it looks exactly like the star fortress that is a five-pointed star. What else, you know, how much more easier can it get?
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing. And again, then we go back to the Vitruvian Man, you know, we can lay out on top, as you did, of course, in your article on the Vatican Key there. But I mean, this suggests then that those who built the Vatican have information about this. They know in a way what is going on. And the question is, if I remember correctly, I think the Vatican was rebuilt at some point into the, you know, what it is today. Do you have any background information on that at all? Who rebuilt it? Do you know?
I couldn't find anything directly on that, but I can assure you it's. The archives, the famous Vatican archives, are holding a whole lot of sensitive materials that people don't like talking about. I can only guess what they're holding. People have speculated that they've got the Grail, they've got a whole lot of things, but who knows? But I would guess that this sort of star pattern is pretty common in ancient times and didn't fit in with general, you know, God-fearing people, that they were building up this law system where they could control people. If you look at all civilizations, I don't even know how you can use the word civilized, you know, when you think how our ancestors treated each other. And basically, they manipulated it to a God-fearing nation. And things that show that we are divine as well, that we are the same lineage as angels. Can you imagine the chaos that would cause? No slavery, No warfare. It would put a stop to everything. So when I think it was quite a good reason to bury it if you wanted to go out and conquer.
Yeah, that's probably it. You're right. And it's kind of a strange thing also, if you know, because I'm having kind of a trouble getting that, you know, the pieces together in that way in my head. If you think about that, many of these institutions that has been so instrumental in, you know, suppressing, as it were, the human race, yet use these kind of symbols in a way that speak of a greater past, perhaps. Then
I think it might be something, if you can imagine putting yourself into their position, and let's say the new pope, for example, has been shown the archive and the great secrets, and how would one release something like this? It's kind of showing that they've kept it away all this time. That's a big embarrassment, number one. Number two, what will it do to people that have a lot of faith in the church and the religion? And, you know, wouldn't it destroy a lot of that? You know,
there's
more damage to be done with this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think what will make it good in the future is to show somehow, and it's going to be probably a long time in the future, where these things are real, that what's on Mars is real, because we've got some kind of tangible evidence, or visitors, or who knows what, but we can show that what they were trying to teach us was good. What we're trying, the fundamentals of all religions have in common, there's a link. For example, the biblical tree of life, it seems quite, as a common foundation in a lot of religions, it's this core of the universe, creation. And bring all that out as well to cover up, you know, the worries and the doubts and that sort of thing. Something wonderful and measurable and touchable, and there it is. You know, there is a God. There is a meaning to our lives. Then it would work. But to bring it out now as an old manuscript and show that it could mean, like what I'm doing in my research as a crazy author, people will say, you know, they can take me with a pinch of salt, but they won't take a document from the Vatican with a pinch of salt. I promise you, it'll do harm. I'd be one of those people that would say, don't release it until we can prove a lot of this stuff.
That
shows you, you know, they've probably all felt the same thing.
Really?
Would you think? Would you think it would be good to release it?
In one way, yeah. I mean, just because of the interest and because of the
of
fact
course.
that we have to...
And I think of your family. Just take your own family. Just how many members of your family are religious?
Actually, none, as far as I know.
But if you imagine religious people,
yeah.
And believe me, to see something that you've always believed in, this is strange about the human nature. We have a habit of belief. To see, after all the years of believing in something, that something's different or wrong or has another way to be interpreted, the feeling inside one's emotional body is quite threatening, quite destroying, quite almost depressing. But, you know, you've been wrong. And, gosh, now this new stuff must be something in disguise. And, of course, I've heard this a lot as well, that the moment if these visitors came down from the sky again, I can imagine if they look adorned in nice clothing, kind, gentle people, I can imagine a million staunch religious people pointing at it and saying, Satan,
disguise. Really?
Shoot them, kill them,
destroy
them.
I mean,
don't you think that will happen?
For me, of course, it's a more of a, you know, philosophical question, to the fact of I can compare it to, like, you know, in the Matrix, you know, is it the red pill or the blue pill? Do you want to live in a, you know, in a lie, or do you actually want to know, even though, you know, follow follow the truth, you know, wherever it might lead, and we'll go from there. I mean, if people are, I mean, I think in a way, I think that kind of you know, protection in a way is actually something that keeping humanity from actually reaching to the levels that are our potential, and potentially that even might be a reason for why we have, you know, such a violent temper and all this. I don't know. I mean, first of all, we have to figure out where the heck we come from. Maybe not what we're doing here. That's more a difficult question, but at least know what we're coming from and have a sense of origin. I think that in itself would, you know, imply a lot of security. I don't know.
It's true. It's just a way that it needs to present itself. And I'm pretty sure maybe even all these secret societies, religions, head bodies are waiting for a time where it would be right, where it would be, you know, guaranteed that it's not going to cause chaos.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what the Eastern religions would think of it, because they're more staunch than Western religion, and how emotional would they feel? Just for example, if the people that came out of the sky were more fair-skinned rather than basically the Egyptian-looking lineage, and that's quite sad that, you know, they would see that it looks different to them. I'm just using an example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm promising now they wouldn't accept it as being something good.
Really?
I'm sure there's so much sensitivity here, you know what I mean? It's I don't think it's a way of presenting itself easily. So,
sheesh.
You know, I can understand cover-up. I really and honestly can.
Really? Sheesh. I mean, it's a very interesting point, so don't get me wrong, but in a way it's like, what the heck, it is what it is. I mean, what can we do about it? Things in the universe,
exactly.
You know, align themselves as the way they align themselves. What we can do nothing about that, right?
I think it would cause more chaos. I really do. Until there's a way of presenting itself more methodically.
Methodically.
With method. Okay, let's just say that. It's something that is so dangerous. It'd be such an emotional time of our civilization. We're at a point where we've overpopulated this earth, and we will pick up a gun in an instant. We will die in an instant just for belief. What does that tell you? You know, we're on the edge of chaos, and it's a very temperamental situation.
Yeah,
I'd honestly like to see more proof before, you know, there is a release. And I think we're actually being provided with it, to be quite honest. Stuff like what I'm doing, my research, is only a small part of, I think other people are doing the same thing and also finding pieces of the puzzle that will present together and see reason, logic, and purity in what has really happened with our past. And I can assure you it'll take 30 years before we accept it. It's a slow process.
Yeah, and I think that actually this is coming then potentially in, you know, if we, you know, consider the fact that there is a lot of research out there and a lot of people interested in the origins of humanity, and you know, people are beginning to take into account the astro-theological aspect, and people are more, you know, in tuned to look at the sky as the source for all of this and so forth. But I think that it's coming from a very good source, meaning that it's coming from a kind of a, what do you call it, a grassroots level kind of thing, that this is an undercurrent. This isn't like a big authority coming in and saying that, okay, this is the new truth now, you know, accept this or, you know, whatever.
I'm pretty sure if you look back at your ancient writings, you'll see that that's what I would pretty much guarantee, that, you know, the basically heavenly visitors, they were them. They came down, they tried to teach us. There it is there. They came with a gentle nature rather than warlike nature. They'll probably see that too. They'll see as well the patterns and symbols that they give us if they do come, would be pretty much something we've seen in our history. Mm. It would start adapting to, you know, going back and looking in the old writings and seeing that, you know, this is us. These are our ancestors, and the human design is something universal. It's not just, you know, we appeared like these creatures in this part of the universe. It's quite likely that the design comes from a nucleus in the universe, and it's radiating out with energy and forms and planets like it everywhere.
Yeah.
There's another thing I want to mention. You know, we've got these three stars in our star map here. SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, radio signal.
Mm.
You know what? If they could just change their protocol, they use a different process, which I think is going off the tracker, but they look in the quiet spectrum of radio waves with this little noise and expecting people out there in the universe to be contacting us and sending out a message to us. I mean, just to think like it frustrates me. Why would they even bother?
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, that's based on that thinking. What we should be doing is looking in the noisy part of the spectrum where most common radio frequencies are, and look for a little bit more than the hiss. Something in there that sounds like a telex or a radio signal, TV signal, or some kind of, you know, intelligent signal with amplifiers, with filters, and I tell you what, we'd find something aiming for one of these three stars that we have in our picture here.
Hmm.
I'd bet money on it. If I had enough to bet, I'm still a struggling author, time will come.
Yeah.
I would put good money on a bet that they'll find something with one of those three.
That's very interesting, and as you say, they're finding more and more planets all the time around, you know, stars that are out there.
Sure.
And you, by the way, you were in, I can't remember if we talked about this last time you were on the show, but you did some correspondent with Seth Shostak, I think it's called, from SETI,
right.
Back in 2000. Yeah.
Very disappointing account, I'm afraid. I thought he was a scientist, open-minded, and would at least look at, you know, probabilities. The first reaction was, number one, sorry, Wayne, we don't take historical theory as science. And I said, well, you're looking for aliens, for heaven's sakes, you know.
Mm.
Let's speak general theory, not just historical theory and trying to put a label on it. Look at probability of statistics, that this pattern is, you know, in ancient civilizations is not just common.
Mm.
Why not just point your radio telescope there and see what you get?
Yeah.
And the second thing I asked him was, have they, you know, measured that area with the current radio pattern that they're looking for and a quiet frequency? And the answer was zero. They haven't got a path showing on those three stars that have been, in other words, they haven't measured anything on those three stars yet.
Yeah.
Which to me is exciting because, you know, it's not like it's been done and it was nothing. You know, they should be have a little bit of interest and just test it, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, exactly.
And you'd rather just forget about it. Which makes you wonder, you know.
Yeah,
have they found something? Are they trying to hide it? Or
yeah.
Probably not. Well, probably they just don't like the UFO people. They're trying, you know, look at themselves as scientists doing a serious research. And what can you say? I get very frustrated because how hard is it to do the test, you know? Just do the test.
Yeah, exactly. But as you say, it's a science, a close-minded scientist. That's what a lot of these guys are. And in a way, I think that it's more about kind of keeping the attention or the focus away from the idea of looking at other options. I mean, I for one actually I don't even, you know, at all look at SETI anymore in any kind of interesting way. It's just I just you know scoff every time I hear it.
Controlled.
Because of the.
I'm just wondering, you know, they yeah. control the. You know, I'd like to ask, we're on a radio show, if there's people listening out there that have a link to a really good radio telescope and somebody who can have permission just to focus on three targets and set it up with good amplification and do a recording of what kind of noise is coming from that star with the hiss. You pick up a little bit of normal natural hiss and then we can probably with really good computers go into that hiss and look for something, you know, in the hiss.
Yeah.
If anybody knows a way of doing that, a university or a link or an astronomer, I failed. I'll tell you what, as an amateur astronomer, I've tried all kinds of people. And the moment you talk about looking for a UFO kind of alien kind of link story, they just the wall comes up straight away.
Really? Yeah. So I mean, what are you know, let's say that someone actually is listening to this and actually have some kind of access to this, but decides to, I don't know what, do it on their own and don't tell anything about it. What should they look for? What kind of frequency? What's happening there?
Yeah, I think anybody who knows a bit about radio telescopes, there's ways of just tuning into different frequencies. Go into the common, what we call the common radio spectrum on Earth, for radios, telecommunications, that frequency, whatever it is in hertz, I think it's measured.
Mm-hmm.
Tune in there and listen and take a recording. We don't look for it now, but you get a really good digital recording of it. And I'm sure there are people out there that are sound engineers that can go in and look inside that and take out the noise, take out the hiss, and look for little rhythmic sounds or something in there that just shows a glimpse of advanced something, radio signal. How hard is that? Surely it, with a good amplifier and a good dish, a good amplifying dish, like the array that they have at the desert in the U.S., have these groups of large radio telescopes. If somebody has access to that, I'm pretty sure there's a good chance something will be found.
Wow, that's fascinating. Hey, Wayne, I thought...
This is real.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. You know, I thought that this would be a good place to take a short break and then continue in a part two. But before we do that, I want you to tell everybody about your website and, of course, mention your book for a lot more of this kind of information for people who are hungry for that. So go ahead and tell us.
Okay. The material we're talking about is predominantly on the main website, which is thehiddenrecords.com, the Hidden Records. The Freemason images and the Freemason story is on the little gold icon you see on the home page with the all-seeing eye. Just click on that. And the new Solomon Key, which hasn't got the full story revealed yet, but I'm sure people with a bit of background from our website will be able to crack the Solomon Key on their own initiative. If you go to keyofsolomon.net, you'll see the basic material there. And I think we've even got an image there of the Baalbek Temple in Lebanon, which looks like a giant human form, which perhaps the Solomon Temple was once built like. I think it'd be probably accurate in saying that if there was a Solomon Temple, that's probably the design code in a human form layout. There's a picture there people can see as well.
Fascinating. Do check it out.
I didn't even mention my book.
Yeah, that's right. Mention your book, of course. Sorry.
Yeah. The Hidden Records you can get from Amazon. I think it's probably the easiest link. And I have a link on my webpage. You can just click on the book. There's different parts all over the world that you can click on for your area.
Excellent. Do check it out. It's thehiddenrecords.com and also keyofsolomon.net. Wayne and I are going to continue this discussion for our subscribers, and we'll get into some fascinating material on Egypt and the Forbidden Star Map, a golden-capped obelisk at Abusir, the Blazing Star, and the connection with Senmut's tomb and the Zodiac Disc at the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. We're also going to talk about Wayne's work on the Key of Solomon, and we'll get into some interesting points about occult symbols, witchcraft, and alchemy. And this is an interview that you definitely don't want to miss. If you want to listen to our continuation of our interview with Wayne, but aren't currently subscribing to Red Ice Creations, I recommend that you pop into our radio archive at our website, redicecreations.com, and click on subscribe to find out how to sign up and tune in. By signing up for 3 months, you will get full access to all our previous radio shows and subscriber interviews. And it's very easy to sign up using PayPal, but if you prefer not using that method, take a look at our alternative payment methods. Thank you so much for tuning in, and my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we'll be back on Thursday with our regular guest Michael Tessarion for an awesome show on the post-human world, AI, the singularity, genomics, and the future of mankind. So do stay tuned to Red Ice Creations Radio. Until next time, take good care. Wandering stars, for whom it is preserved, the blackness, the darkness forever. Wandering stars, for whom it is preserved, the blackness, the darkness forever. Those who have seen the needles I now tread, like a husk from which your thought was now has bled, and the masks that the monsters wear to feed upon the prey. Wandering stars, for whom it is preserved, what the